We have been enjoying this spring and summer of 2014, bringing you a number of artists, writers, musicians, academics, and others who are Chicagoans, but you either might not know them or you might know who they are but not realize they're in Chicago. And what was the old Harry Porterfield, Somebody You Should Know, on local Channel 2 years ago, as I recall. So these are people whose work you should know, and we think that you should also know them individually. And they're also people, I find, who have many different capacities and wear many hats, if not simultaneously, certainly serially. And that applies very much to our guest today. I met Margaret Hawkins, I would guess, in the late 1980s, probably. We were both journalisting in Chicago, in and around the Sun-Times. And I think over the years, you were an editor there and a writer there. And then you were the art critic or wrote a column on Art Weekly.
I was never an editor, okay. But I was a critic, and I had a column for many years.
Okay, okay. Yeah. And you knew some editors, right?
I knew lots of editors.
Right. And I was doing stuff for the paper starting in 1991. Gosh, it goes back. And we also had, for a period, believe it or not, in Chicago, we had a merry crew of art critics.
Not even so merry.
Well, true, but I mean the point being a merry band or crew in the sense that it was an active thing.
Yes.
We still have this amazing art scene in Chicago, but art criticism, which we were told the World Wide Web was going to make universal, and in fact, all it did is mean we don't have any art criticism anymore in Chicago, or very little.
Oh, you know, there are a lot of blogs, but we all know about blogging. I mean, there's quite a range of qualities. So, yeah, we don't have art criticism in the form we used to. It's kind of heartbreaking for us old art critics who revered the form and each other.
And we had columns and critics in both daily papers, in Chicago Magazine, in the Chicago Reader. We had a national, even international magazine based here for years, decades, the New Art Examiner.
A very good magazine.
And those things have changed. We're going to come back to that because I know you still keep your eye on art and you still keep a hand in its discussion and display. But the other day, I got a package in the mail and I opened it up and I said, wow. Margaret Hawkins has written and had published by a major publisher a novel. And then I said, wow, I'm out of it. This is her third novel published by a major publisher. And you've also written a nonfiction memoir about your life and your sister and her struggle with schizophrenia.
Yeah, not so much about my life.
Well, but about how it affects
those
around
together.
People. Your life together.
And our family, yeah.
And you teach at the School of the Art Institute in which department or departments?
I teach in two departments, actually. In the art history department, I teach writing. And then I teach in the New Arts Journalism program, which is a graduate program training young art writers.
To go out into the world and have no job. But I mean, at least they'll be ready.
Right? It's a sensitive point. I hope my students are not listening. No, there will be a role for them, just different than the ones we played, I think.
Right. And that's going to have to be, I think, the generation that's going to have to figure out where the next place to go, because the previous generations are still muddling around without having figured that out. The new or new-ish book is Lydia's Party. And we're going to talk about it, but probably, as we do here, somewhat around it, because, one, books have plots. Many of them do. This one has a plot. It has surprise elements in it. And also, we want you to read the book. And I can assure you that not that the book is light in the sense of unimportant, but it moves. And it moves very much, I think, in real time. And it is written in a way that you feel as if you are a part of this group of women friends experiencing both their past and their gathering at this annual party thrown by their friend and sort of captain Lydia. We've seen wonderful comments about the book from such international novelists as Diane Johnson, and also terrific reviews from Kirkus Book List, Publishers Weekly, and other places. And we'll come back to that. It's Viking has brought out Lydia's Party by Margaret Hawkins. But let's talk a bit first about Margaret, and tell us a bit about your background and how you went into writing about things and writing about art and where the novel started coming from. Your time.
Thank you. I started as a visual artist. I think a lot of artists do, people who work in other art forms. So as a maker, you know, of some kind. And which is how I got drawn into writing about art, because I think I was always a writer by temperament and nature, and just sort of I was determined to be. So I was writing about art.
What kind of art were you making, and did you study it formally, or did you just start doing it as a kid, or both?
Yeah, both. But I studied art in graduate school and got an MFA and was a painter. And I think I was really more of a drawer. Somehow that was really the medium that was most interesting and most immediate to me and most related to my thoughts, which is kind of how writing is. It's the most direct.
Drawing really does have that connection to description and storytelling, doesn't it?
Exactly.
It does. And the hand.
Exactly, the hand. I mean, I still always keep a notebook with me. It's sitting right here on the table in front of me in the studio, in fact. So, yeah, drawing and writing, I think, are very, very linked, in keeping a notebook and all that. Anyway, so I was invited to write a standalone piece for the Chicago Sun-Times. And I wrote that, and then they invited about art, about a show at the Renaissance Center that where the Chicago artists made portraits of members of the Chicago White Sox, and it was their 75th anniversary.
The Renaissance Society.
The Renaissance Society.
Down at the University of Chicago.
At University of Chicago. And it was their 75th anniversary, and it was the White Sox 75th anniversary.
Oh.
So someone came up with this ingenious idea for an exhibition of pairing Chicago artists with members of the team. And so I wrote about that. I got to go down to the park and interview the players, and it was great fun.
Yes.
So so they liked me, and they invited me to do another story and then another. And in after a couple months, they invited me to do a column. So I started writing that in the late 80s, and it went for, gosh, about 20 years.
Right.
And it was weekly, and then there was a hiatus, and then I came back every other week, and then it became weekly again. So it went on for a long time.
Right.
But while I was writing that, I realized that I had a yen to expand and write something longer and fictional, to make it up. And there was always the temptation, you know, when writing these reviews to begin telling stories. And I really found myself kind of drawn in that direction. And it was, I really had to kind of rein myself in and stick to the facts. Obviously, journalism is not fiction, but it is storytelling. And it's all related.
Right.
So, so long story short, and I was writing short stories, in fact, but not doing anything with them. So I decided it was time to start working on a novel. So I did that, and that's what eventually became my first novel.
And when was that, and how did you go about getting a sense of whether this was something you could, as they might not say as much anymore, but take out of the drawer? Maybe now it would be hit the send button. how did you have an advisor, counselor, teacher, guide?
Honestly, no, Andrew. After all those years of being a critic, I just did not want to show it to anyone. Not a single person. I didn't tell anyone.
That is probably the most honest thing any critic could say. We don't want to be told what to do. Our job is
telling
other people.
To tell people what to do. I know. Isn't that terrible?
But it's also honest of you to say that was the reason.
It's true. And I didn't know what I was doing, or I knew, I sort of knew what I was doing by my own standards, but I had no idea if that would jibe with what anyone else thought I should be doing. And I thought, well, I don't have a deadline. I don't have an editor. I don't have an agent. I don't have a publisher. I don't have anything. Nobody knows I'm doing this. So the longer I can do it in private, I almost said secret. It was kind of secretive, but just in private without having to make it conform to anything.
Did you have a time of day or a specific place where you would work or a time of the year that you would have more time to devote to it?
Well, I was actually working, you know, a full-time job at the time. So I wrote in the evenings or sometimes early in the morning. I like to, when I can, I mean, I'm not like a compulsive morning person, but when I can, I like to get up early and work because there's a kind of a freshness. I'm not exactly alert early in the morning, but but my mind is blank in a way that's suitable to writing.
Interesting that is a good description, that the morning is really when we're in many ways at our best and least want to work or write.
Right.
David Halberstam always said he would do his writing in the morning and then stop at about 11:30 or 12 and do all the things that take up the day. Whereas if he started doing that in the morning, then the day would be gone. So a good example of the discipline of just saying, no, the morning I should be, when I can, writing.
Yeah. I know they say that Hemingway would go to his little room when he was working in Key West, and there was a bridge from his house, like a catwalk.
Mm-hmm.
And he would walk across this bridge into this little room and write in the morning. And then when he was done, he would leave and spend the rest of the day drinking, I think.
Yeah, but he also would, on the wall, he had that piece of paper where he would write how many words he had written. That was the scariest thing when I went into that house in Key West.
Yeah.
I'd read that he did that, but then to see, my gosh. Well, but in many ways, sometimes that's what it takes, right?
Sometimes you just need to come up with some artificial motivation,
right?
Be it time or word count. This was before word count. Just think, he actually hand counted
them. Yes, he did. So when you decided you were done, what did you do then?
Well, that's exactly what happened. I decided I was done. I got to the end. And then I went out. I remember this vividly. I went out on a Sunday afternoon. There was a Bears game going on, and it was snowing, so nobody was on the road. And I drove to a bookstore, a Barnes & Noble, and I bought that book, A Guide to Literary Agents, and I took it home, and I went through the list. I mean, there are hundreds. I went through the list of agents, and I checked off everyone that represented literary fiction. And then I went back and put another check mark next to every one of those that accepted pages from someone that they didn't know. And then I went through and made a third check on anyone who looked like they just had some connection to something that was true of me. And
that could have been style, it could have been geography, it could have been gender.
Exactly. All or any of the above. And then some, you know, weirder things like, you know, people interested in, well, just, you know, matters of spirituality or art or anything that I thought could be remotely used to describe my book. So then I got that really brought the list down.
Right.
There weren't many left. I think there were 20-something. And so I simply went about sending exactly the number of pages, because nobody wanted the whole manuscript.
Right.
They wanted either the first chapter, the first three chapters, the first 10 pages, or the first 30 pages. I think those were the four different ways they wanted it. So I just sent them out, and someone got back to me.
And so was that the one person who got back, or the first person who got back, or?
Good question. I used to have an obsessive calculus of who said what. There were some flat no's. There were some polite no's. There were some very enthusiastic no's. And then
enthusiastic meaning keep it up, or we really never want to hear from you again.
No, there was no enthusiastic negativity, but no people who said we really like it, but we're not looking for anyone, you know, write us back in a year, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And then this one agent said, I really like it. Please send me the whole manuscript and don't sign with anyone else until you've talked to me.
I don't think of all the authors I've known or talked to, and being a nonfiction author myself, that I've ever heard of somebody succeeding by doing it the correct way, which was the way that you did it, which was on your own terms.
It was on my own terms. I was still in this obsessive mode of not telling anyone. So it's like, well, I don't know these people. I can just, you know, I can have this virtual relationship with them through email and the mail.
And the agent was able to...
Yeah.
To move with it?
Yeah, she sold it. She sold the first book to a small press in New York mm-hmm. called Permanent Press.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was which? This was A Year of Cats and Dogs?
A Year of Cats and Dogs, mm-hmm. yes. Yeah, and so and since then, I now have a new agent.
Right.
And, but anyway, that was a wonderful experience. I mean, it was really kind of life-changing.
And once you got something published, even if it was with a, quote, small publisher, you have... the physicality of the existence of the book.
Absolutely.
You have reviews. My first book was.
Yeah, that was nice. And in advance, you know, with a royalty structure. I mean, it was very small.
Right.
But it still felt, it made it feel like a professional relationship to get a contract. And
tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, boy, that one's a hard one to talk about, and I haven't read it in a long time. But it's that was something I was determined to write it the way I wanted to write it. I probably would never have gotten away with this if I'd had to make a pitch,
mm-hmm.
because people would have said no, thank you. But it was the form. Well, it's a story about a woman making changes in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And in this process, as she kind of goes inside, she discovers that she has this ability to communicate with animals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's meant to be true and realistic and poignant. It's also about something that many people think is nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay because the character believes in it.
Right.
So it can either be funny or it can be sort of sad that she has this, you know, belief, depending on where you stand in the issue, or it can simply be true. You know, I know
right.
people who say, well, that's absolutely how it works with my animals. So anyway, it's meant to be interpretable from different points of view. But anyway, in this process, she is able to kind of reformulate her life. And it's very much about death and about change. And the structure of the book, I was struggling with the structure. It felt just kind of flat-footed, like it needed something to kind of contain it in terms of, you know, where it would start and where it would end. And then I got the idea of putting it, like, or putting the I Ching around it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 64 possible throws in the I Ching. And then it kind of snapped into place for me because it's sort of also about randomness
mm-hmm.
and how randomness can either feel random, and that's a sort of a pessimistic view, or it can feel like destiny, and that's an optimistic way to see it. And so when things happen to you, you can feel like a victim, or you can feel that there's some kind of pattern that you're discovering in it. So I thought that would be interesting to apply that structure to this person's story and sort of have her discover her life, her own, discover her future through this process of apparently random aphorisms that occur in her life. And people kept saying at the beginning, maybe it was my editor among others, but, you know, I'm not sure I see the connection between all these I Ching sayings and what actually happens. And that's part of the point. That's not just sort of, that isn't just random. It's the idea that there's this disconnect, and then your brain kind of expands to understand how this thing that doesn't seem to apply does apply. It's like when you get a fortune cookie and you open it and you read it and it says some weird thing and you say, huh. And then, like, you know, later that night you think, huh.
Yeah.
You know, and it starts to make sense.
Right. There, a couple of things come to mind from other parts of the arts. I think many learned over the years from John Cage that randomness is a structure and leads to a structure.
Yes, it does.
And then I think people sort of began to accept that and to realize that, as you said with the fortune cookie, they could see that in their own lives. It's not the only structure,
no.
but it's a tool and it's a way, and for some artists it it works. And I'm also reminded that I went to see Paul Taylor Dance Company at the Auditorium first time. They've been in the city there at the Auditorium in 30-some years. And I was looking back at recent reviews. I love the company. I love Paul Taylor in New York. And their main dance critic at the New York Times is very much a ballet person. And Paul Taylor is very much not a ballet person. He's a dance person. Had some silly throwaway comment where he said, "You know, each dance, of course, in the program has an aphorism." He likes to put an aphorism, and I feel sometimes looking at the program, I'm looking at the collected aphorisms of Paul Taylor. Well, obviously, he's not putting the aphorism in front of each dance so that you will sit and read 64 aphorisms. He's saying, here's what was in my head or came to my head, and while you're looking at my dance, maybe you'll make a connection. And no one's going to, it's as if somebody took a book and just read all the chapter titles. Right. Well, I didn't care for that book. So many chapter titles, right?
Too many titles.
Right. So you were doing this as a way of looking and thinking, right?
Yeah. And it creates a discourse, mm-hmm. you know? And so there is this other kind of thread of conversation going through the story. What is that called? Aleatorical?
Yeah. Exactly. I was going to say, in fact, in music, they like to throw the fancy term on. It is aleatorical, and this is what Ludoslavsky and Lucas Foss and other composers would do. But yeah, chance.
Chance, in other words.
Right. So you have the Year of Cats and Dogs. It gets out there. It gets good response. And now the secret is out, though. People know that you are doing this. So does that change the way you approach novel number two?
You know, I started writing novel number two before novel number one came mm-hmm. out. So a few people mm-hmm. knew that I had written it and then sold it. But I was well into the second one before the first one came out. There's quite a long span of time in this process, there has been for me for the books I've written. So I was actually working on two more books before, and those sold, in fact, before my first novel came out. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of nice. It was like a little cushion of privacy. So I was well into those, and it allowed me to write them according to my own, you know, my own inclination rather than with a sense of, well, they said this about this, so I should do that, which is a problem, I think, for a lot of writers.
Right. That you can be intimidated or you can feel a need that you have to do something, quote, different, or you have to do something, quote, the same.
Yeah, both. Yeah.
And that's very difficult. That second book is or the second anything is often the most difficult, even though it might also lead to other breakthroughs.
Sure.
We're speaking with Margaret Hawkins, Hawkins. You know her name probably if you're a Chicagoan and you follow art or followed art, because for 20-plus years she wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times and other publications on visual art in and around Chicago. And you now know her name as the author of The Year of Cats and Dogs, How to Survive a Natural Disaster, and her newest novel, published by Viking, Lydia's Party. She has other books as well, and we're catching up with her personally and professionally. I'm catching up with her, and you're catching up with her too, and we're enjoying that as well. You also had the nonfiction book about you and your sister and your sister's schizophrenia. Tell us about how that came about and how that compared and contrasted with your work with fiction.
Well, that came about because while I was writing Cats and Dogs, my father died. And my father, he died at the age of 89, and he had been caring for my sister for his, you know, for much of his life.
Right.
She'd been independent. It wasn't like a continuous caretaking situation for her whole life. But after she came back to live – in the family home in her early 30s. My parents continued to take care of her, and then my mother died. And then mm-hmm. when my father died, I became her legal guardian. So the issue, so there were all kinds of issues that came up around that. And before he died, there was this, you know, sort of, you know, this understanding that his, you know, he was getting weaker, he was getting sicker, and something would have to be done. And she'd never been formally diagnosed. She'd never seen a psychiatrist. She'd never been medicated.
Wow.
And she hadn't left the house in, I'm kind of losing track here, but approximately 30 years. So, and she was very, very ill. And there were times when she was nearly catatonic. She wouldn't allow any physical contact. She wouldn't make eye contact. She wouldn't, she was exhibiting all the signs of severe schizophrenia. So then my father died, and it became both my brother and I, but because I'm here and because I was her, you know, official legal guardian, I had to decide what to do. So there were some very hard choices, and, you know, lots of people were saying, well, you know, it's time to put her somewhere. And I just couldn't accept that mm-hmm. without at least trying some other options. And so so I went about trying to find, you know, caregivers, and then I found a social worker. And the social worker, this wonderful woman whose name is Wendy Trafney, thank you, Wendy, who still works now for an organization called the New Foundation Center, which is fantastic. If anybody has a family situation like this, contact them. She then
well, it's appreciated.
They're really wonderful. You know, this is hard stuff. You know, there are no easy answers, but they are in the trenches trying to figure it out. Anyhow, she found a psychiatrist who was willing to come to the house. Because, of course, all along, that part of the issue was, well, if you won't forcibly take her somewhere she won't go willingly. You know, people would say, well, take her to a psychiatrist. Well, she won't leave the house. Well, then, you know, there's this whole matter of force and all these things. So this guy came to the house, and long story short, I mean, it's in the book, and
right.
it was quite a dramatic day in my life. But he diagnosed her, and he was leaving. He was about to leave, and I said, would you consider writing a prescription for something that might help? And he looked thoughtful. And then he said, well, and then he put on his coat. He went out to his car. It was, you know, snowstorm February. It's trudging through this, you know, snowdrift down the stairs. Comes back in, writes a prescription for 0.25 milligram of this antipsychotic. And I went to the pharmacy immediately, brought it back. And that evening, that minute I walked in, she took the first dose. And she's been taking it ever since, and she started to improve immediately.
You call the book, the subtitle, The Year of My Sister's Reawakening.
Yeah.
Did you have a sense of regret or multi-generational guilt or anything that perhaps something could have been done earlier?
Sure, sure. And that's, of course, all in the book.
Right.
I mean, those thoughts and worries and, you know, regret and second guessing and all that stuff. But it was such a complicated situation.
Sure.
If my parents had, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, thoughts about, you know, recriminations about why didn't they do more. But whatever I or anyone else thinks about that, if, in fact, they had imposed some kind of treatment on mm-hmm. her when she first got sick, she would have received a very different kind of treatment.
Right, right.
Because the quality of the drugs now are amazingly better.
Right. There's such a different understanding of these diseases,
right.
And there's also parallel, sometimes coincident to and sometimes related to the behavioral research, there's much more pharmacological and
right.
and body physiological understanding than there was.
Right.
So right, it could have gone in. Oh. I mean, Tennessee Williams would talk about this and write about this throughout his entire life, people who were given lobotomies or
yes.
institutionalized when
right.
today they might be given a pill, or
right.
people who were given pills that caused all kinds of things, yet
right.
maybe they would have been violent in certain cases otherwise.
Right.
And
right.
And as you wrote about and as you're talking about here, fortunately here the point was there was this reawakening, and you probably could send a message to your father somewhere that things were okay.
Yeah. I mean, it very much felt like something I was doing sort of in retro, you know, retroactively for my parents as much also as for my sister.
We're talking to Margaret Hawkins. She's a writer, journalist, and teacher. And her third novel, her third published novel, because she's secretive, so for all we know, she has 18 novels sitting there at home. She's not telling us about them until they're published. In addition to getting some more of this background, I'm also very interested in this kind of, I don't want to call it a zigzag, maybe set of accretions of different kinds of writing and different things that you examine, because I think a part of what your writing fiction has been about, from the way I read it, is a reminder to people that we each have stories and that we each have backstories that people are not necessarily aware of. Even old friends may not know. And one of the things I think as we get older and we realize, wow, I didn't know so-and-so has been looking after her mother for 35 years, or I didn't know so-and-so's brother lives with his parents, and that's why I never really see his parents socializing, or
right.
that kind of thing. And I think it's something that you're able to do in an honest and direct, and again, the way I said light without a negative side, casual way rather than a disease of the week kind of book, which might sell more, but
yeah.
wouldn't be a real piece of literature or a real attempt at literary fiction.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll take that. Tell us a bit about that second published novel, How to Survive a Natural Disaster, which your books have great titles. So.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Not everybody says that, but I sort of fought for that title, which is kind of a weird one. And I realized after that I wrote two books during that sort of dramatic period in my life, both of which started with the word how. And I think I was thinking, I don't know how to do this.
Mm.
I do not know how. Mm. And so I was thinking about, I think it was almost like a unconscious pun on my part. It was a how-to book for someone who doesn't know how.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But anyway, that that book is, that title is based on the one of the characters who obsessively reads the CNN headlines that show up on her screen every morning. And they're just full of gore and violence and human suffering from small tragedies to worldwide, genocide. So she's just frozen by the horror that appears on her screen. And one of them is How to Survive a Natural Disaster. And she starts to have this kind of mental riff about how does one and what is a natural disaster. Mm. And could that term be applied to family life?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really about a very troubled family and how they interact. And each character in the book, not just the family, but the friends and various other parties, narrate in the first person.
Right.
So it goes back and forth among each character.
Lydia's party finds you with Viking and the wider opportunities and exposure that can bring. Tell us about how the book came together, and then maybe if you would read something from the book for us.
I'd love to. Thank you, Andrew. The way that book came together is, well, I actually started writing this book before the first novel was published, because I could see on my computer that the file,
yeah.
I didn't realize I started it that long
wow.
ago. But
you've done an archaeological excavation of your own writing.
Right? I have, and the computer makes it easy.
Yeah.
But I, I started writing that, and I actually wrote each character in first person, and that just didn't work. And so after, you know, working on it for years that way, I realized I needed to go back and rewrite it in third person so that it would be clear who was thinking what and doing what. But I wrote it. My first agent sent it around. She couldn't sell it. We, you know, there was just sort of this impasse and not knowing right. what to do. And I thought, well, okay. And then I remembered something that I had forgotten all about, and that is that when my first book came out, a wonderful review of it appeared, written by a novelist that I didn't know. Her name's Joanne Mapson. Mm-hmm. She's a beautiful writer. She has a new book coming out this summer, I think, with Bloomsbury. And she wrote a great review, and I tracked her down to thank her. And when I did, she wrote me back and said, "Do you have an agent? Because I think my agent would represent you." And I said, "Oh, thank you. That's so sweet of you, but I have an agent." And then these few years later, right. when my agent couldn't sell this book, and I contacted this person again and said, "Is that offer still good? I understand if it's not." And she said, "Oh, of course." And yeah. she, a few minutes later, I got an email from her agent saying, "Oh, yes, she sent me your book, your first book, and I liked it very much. And I would be really interested in seeing what else you have."
These are important things. I think they're not just back of the manual points. Writers have lives.
Yeah.
And we have decisions to make, and we have things that block us, some of which are in our heads, 99%
mostly.
Of them, right?
yeah.
Some of which are in the world around us. And that decision about whether to keep your agent or whether your agent might have a decision whether to keep you
is
one of the big things that happens. And one has to remember that, gee, if I met a doctor and I thought the doctor would do a better job with my child or with
yeah.
my leg, you'd go to the new doctor.
Yeah.
And sometimes yeah. it just, but at the same time, a relationship has been built up and this person right. was there for you at
right.
a time when no one else was there for you. And
right.
and yet these things have to happen if people keep moving on. And sometimes if we see mm-hmm. it with, quote, the big and famous, we think, oh, they're callous or they yeah. just want money. Maybe it was they had a project that they really believed in and the other person couldn't quite see why or couldn't make it go.
Yeah. And that was kind of how this was. And in fact, you know, when she made that offer originally, I said, wow, you know, because she had this New York agent. And
mm-hmm.
I said, but I have this agent. So I like her. She sold my book. And so I didn't go with it then. But after she, you know, there was this sort of this slowing down of, you know, mm-hmm. there wasn't any more action. And we both, it was amicable.
Right.
You know, we're
right.
still in touch. You know,
good.
I am very appreciative for what she did for me.
Right.
But it was, I think it was mutual. So it was
right.
just time.
So new agent liked your old book, liked your new book?
Yeah.
And was willing to not tell you how to rewrite it or did want you to make changes to
She
it.
Had a little, she had some ideas.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, I was open to it. And again, I had written this one without any input from anyone.
Right.
So finally, by the time I had someone, you know, who liked it, who had some ideas about it, I was open. And they were very respectful and not, you know, not in the spirit of the book.
Right.
And so I rewrote the ending and sent it in, and she sold it very soon after that.
Right.
Yeah.
Why don't you give us a taste
of the
chicken stew?
Do you have a
No, whatever you would like to. It can be from any part of it. I'm not
okay.
going to say more than to say, though, that the title is Lydia's Party and that I like the dedication because the dedication says, "For my friends," and I think that's an important part. And I'm also going to tell you there is an aphorism. I'm sorry, Alistair Macaulay of the New York Times. It's from Carl Jung, and it says, "We cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning will be little at evening, and what in the morning was true will at evening have become a lie."
Lydia, 9 o'clock a.m. Lydia needed to prepare. In 10 hours, the women would begin to arrive for what they'd come to call the bleak midwinter bash. Lydia gave the party every year, and every year she dreaded it. Not the event itself, but the possibility of failure. It hadn't happened yet, but this might be the year. Lydia had named the party after her favorite Christmas carol, a hymn in a minor key. Mostly, she liked the beginning. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow. Beautiful, she thought, that ingenious repetition, clearly written by someone who knew her snow, knew its hypnotic properties, its ability to bury and silence. The song sounded to Lydia like here and now, Chicago in January. Lydia remembered the year the temperature hit 27 below when it hurt to breathe. The tradition, if you could call it that, had started 19 years before, as the Christmas party Lydia didn't get around to organizing until the last week of January. The date stuck long enough after the holidays to offer fresh appeal. By then, everyone was ready for something again, minus all that red and shininess and expectation, when the seasonal imperative to be cheerful had passed. Being warm and having enough to eat, and particularly to drink, was party enough in January. As often as not, the night of the party turned out to be the coldest night of the year. Some years the thermostat read well below zero when guests arrived. Those years she'd handed them blankets and shawls at the door in exchange for their coats. One year half the guests stayed overnight. Cars wouldn't start. Just as well, they'd agreed the next day. None of them was fit to drive. When her friends asked, Lydia said she didn't know how many times she'd given the party. Didn't want to appear compulsive, but she did know. She remembered everyone and what she'd served and who was there. It was an unlucky 13, counting tonight. The first year had been spontaneous, a whim planned at the last minute for a few colleagues. She hadn't expected most of them to show up, but everyone did. And the next year someone said, "Are you going to have that party again?" So she did, and again everyone came, and after that it was expected. She'd missed a few years early on for various deaths and rough spots, though not lately. Not that there hadn't been more of those, just that she'd come to realize she had to give it no matter what, that death and disappointment were no reason not to have a party, that in fact they were the best reason of all. They, the women, Lydia's friends, would start to arrive around 7. Lydia checked the temperature, 2 below now, though it was supposed to go up to a high of 12. She hoped their cars would start, but she no longer worried, as she had in the early years, that they wouldn't show up. If someone were stranded, Celia probably and that old beater of theirs, someone else would collect her. It had gotten to be that important, a kind of summit meeting. Norris was the only one who was iffy, but even she had said she'd come this year. Now Lydia just worried they'd show up early before she was ready. She had much to prepare, the house, the food, herself, the letters. Maxine needed a walk. Somewhere, Lydia would need to fit in a nap so she'd seem bright, unfazed by the effort this was going to take.
The opening portion of Lydia, and I should say Lydia's with a Y, well, then there's an I after the A, Lydia's party, Margaret Hawkins, and that the melancholy that you've described and that you make clear is sort of a thread rather than a great dark cloud, is offset in the way any gathering is by the feel and the movement of stories and of laughter and of sadness and of shock in the case where there's an intention behind a party. I think most parties we go to, we don't expect shock. And so when one happens, it has a purpose here. I, as I said, I don't want to say too much more about the book because we want you to read it and we want you to find your own surprise in it. Did you want to read a little from the other part? Or
I'd be happy to.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, this is a scene that takes place in a grocery store about a third the way through the book. And this is another character, Celia, who is probably Lydia's best friend. Celia pushed a shopping cart up and down the produce aisle in the big discount grocery store. Even with her coat on, it was cold, and the store was too brightly lit, and the floor was wet and dirty. Everyone was tracking in snow, which promptly turned to mud. Celia wheeled her cart past 17 varieties of cabbage, imagining the beautiful tray of raw vegetables she'd take to Lydia's, trying to decide whether to buy parsley or kale to garnish it, and deciding on kale because it was tough and she could rinse it off and cook it later. She wondered whether to splurge on baby carrots or just buy whole big ones and cut them into sticks. She was admiring the purple gloss on the eggplants and the white sheen on the parsnips and feeling better and better and staring at the lemons in their beautiful pyramid of yellowness when a feeling of pure joy washed over her and she realized why. Bruce Springsteen was blasting all around her. They were playing Glory Days in the grocery store. Now, woven together into meaningful oneness by music, the cheap vegetables and deeply discounted bruised fruit, and bins of frozen rabbits all seemed different, connected, and beautiful, even in the harsh fluorescent light. Celia knew how deceptive music could be, full of cheap harmonic tricks that told you how to feel, taking you somewhere soft and melting and then dropping you flat when it was over. She knew they only played it to relax the customers, make them buy more. Usually she hated it. But this was different. This was Bruce. Celia looked around at the other shoppers in their shapeless winter coats, their grimy scarves trailing in the slush on the floor to see if anyone else was getting the Bruce vibe. But the playful, fulfilled people, who might have even, a few of them, been moving semi-ironically in time to the music, were all across town at the high-priced grocery store. Here, shopping for bargain lettuce was no laughing matter. Celia stood still. Around her, elderly, parchment-skinned women in bright lipstick and high-heeled boots tottered behind shopping carts, trying not to slip on the wet floor while they pawed for coupons in their cavernous purses. And a drift-looking man with long, greasy hair stared morosely at a frozen pizza display. No one seemed to notice Bruce. "Here we are," Celia thought, "stocking up on our briskets and chicken drumstick economy packs, our septic-safe toilet paper and fig preserves, while all around us, Bruce and Clarence, redemptive, raucous, rollicking Bruce and Clarence, were rocking out, offering heaven for the mere price of attention." She searched for someone, anyone, to share it with, but no one, not even the sweet-faced stock boys, would even look at her. What a waste, she thought, feeling vibrant and sexy at one with the produce. She wished Peter were there, though he wasn't a Springsteen fan. Suddenly, Celia couldn't wait to get home. For starters, she'd wash her hair. Then, right in front of her, like a sign from God, she saw Peter's absolute favorite, ripe raspberries, shipped all the way from Chile. She grabbed 2 pints, then 2 more, and put them in her cart without even looking at the price. She had a wonderful thought then, almost an epiphany. Maybe, despite appearances, everyone here felt this way. Maybe, underneath all their tired, badly lit surfaces, their coarse bodily skins and fearful, dull eyes, there dwelled beautiful, bright, ageless spirits just like hers. Celia remembered something she'd heard on public radio. An autistic woman who'd written a book about animals' emotions claimed that cats were not as cool as everyone thought. Cats had emotions too, this woman said, exactly like dogs and people, only you couldn't tell, because they didn't have eyebrows to express them. Now, Celia was stunned with the profundity of it. Maybe the convergence of these 2 facts was a secret of universal love. One, on the outside, they all had dried mucus crusted to the ends of their noses and were wearing sweatpants and unbecoming hats. Soon, all their bodies would die, but, and, two, none of them was what he or she appeared to be. Inside, they were all wild and alive, like her. Cats had emotions, too. Then, just as Celia felt drenched with oxytocin, her spirit growing so large it was about to burst out of her body and ascend to a plane of Christ-like empathy and perfect beauty, the song ended. The glow around the fruit vanished. Celia stood, disoriented, in mid-fondle, holding an Asian pear. Fluorescent light illuminated brown spots on the pear that matched the ones on her hand. Someone bumped her cart and didn't apologize. Celia caught a glimpse of her reflection in the dairy case, a tall, pale, middle-aged woman with strange hair and bad posture, wearing an overcoat with a drooping hem, blocking the aisle with a cart that contained 4 tiny plastic cartons of overpriced raspberries. She put the raspberries back. They weren't locally grown. Peter would disapprove. And then an ugly new song began to play.
I love everything about that, and I especially love "but and," because I think "but and" is kind of the point of life, of her revelation of what we do, of the way we live now, of our lives in shopping stores and supermarkets especially, and how we see ourselves and wish we could see ourselves as others see us, as the poet proposed, and the way, even when we are aware of how music is manipulating us, we still let it happen.
Someone said, and I wish I could remember who this was. I wish I had said it, but I didn't. Someone said that music convinces us that we have souls. And I think the person who said it was being sort of snarky, like we don't have souls, but music fools us.
That's an interesting one. I mean, I think of Noel Coward's something to the effect of incredible how potent cheap music is. And but it's both. It's both of those. It's the high and the low aspect that we have eyebrows and we have souls when we hear music or when we read things that make us both think and to see ourselves. And I think those are things that happen when you read Lydia's Party, published by Viking, by Margaret Hawkins, Chicago's own. Where did you go to high school, Margaret?
I went to high school at Maine South High School in Park Ridge.
Now, is that where either Hillary Clinton or Harrison Ford went? Or I can't keep the Souths, Wests, Easts, and Norths straight.
Well, I know about this because my brother and sister are older than I am. So they went to Maine East.
Okay.
And Harrison Ford went there. And Hillary, I think, went there for a couple of years, and then she transferred to Maine South.
Ah, to be closer to where you would be later.
Where I was later, that's right. So I claim her.
Sure, and we claim you with Park Ridge and Alfonso Iannelli and the other artists who made Park Ridge their home. John Alden Carpenter, composer of early Chicago. And you also keep a hand and an eye on the arts, and you're involved with something called Arts and...
It's the Art and Heritage...
Art and Heritage...
Initiative.
Initiative. Tell us a bit about that while we
It's a loose organization of art-interested people who have put on this exhibition of photographs by a German photographer that's up now at the Donk House.
Right. So that's at the triple intersection of Western... Lawrence and Lincoln.
Very good. Yeah. Yes, it is. And there's street parking for a fee, of course. But this German photographer photographs walls. And he grew up in Berlin, and he began photographing the Berlin Wall before it came down and then when it came down.
And this, of course, this is the 25th anniversary of the wall coming down.
Exactly. Right? And that was the impetus for this exhibition. But after that wall came down, he, became aware that new walls were being built. And his assumption that this would be the end of walls that, enclosed people and separated people and ghettoized people, that expectation was, in fact, not going to be fulfilled. And so he started to travel around the world photographing other walls, so Korea, Israel, Palestine. There's one in Morocco, I believe.
Right, the West, separating this province and the country, right?
Right. Spain is actually there. And, of course, the United States. A fence, not a wall, but it serves the same function. So this exhibition includes his photographs, which are large scale, and they're wallpapered on the wall. So it creates this very intimate and claustrophobic feeling. Some of them are, 8 feet, maybe 10 feet long. It's quite a striking exhibition. I was involved tangentially in putting it together. There were more central people who did the main heavy lifting on it. But I'm excited about it, and I want to get the word out.
Yeah, and the thing here that hits me is your interest in the work. We say the artist's name is Kai Wiedenheffer.
Thank you for
Freedom
pronouncing
Forward.
That for me, Andrew.
And the interest here is looking and things that seem to be objects and then thinking, and that's something that is about the way you look at art and the way you look at lives and the way you look at writing. So to me, it all fits very nicely together.
Well, thank you for seeing it that way. Yeah, storytelling really, I guess, is my, is my primary interest. And, photographs and images that tell stories are particularly exciting to me.
We'll put a link up, but I'll just tell you, if you look for Art and Heritage Initiative, either Google or on Tumblr, you'll find it. And the show at the Dankhaus, D-A-N-K, German-American Cultural Center, which has gone through an incredible revival with a lot of young people, some of them not German at all, but many of them aware of Chicago's rich German-American heritage. That's up through June 20. So you can find both the live show, i.e., you'll be the live part of going to the show, and the website. And you can find, well, there used to be bookstores everywhere, but whether it's at a bookstore or online, you can find Lydia's Party by Margaret Hawkins. Viking is the publisher. Margaret, it's been so great catching up with you and seeing how many wonderful things have happened since they took newspapers away from us.
Isn't that sad? We have to keep them alive in our hearts.
Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The music we opened with tonight, Stone Soul Picnic, written in 1967 by a 19-year-old Laura Nyro, who already had hits even before then, from its most known recording, 1968, The Fifth Dimension. Bones Howe produced that on the Soul City label. And I don't know, it always carries me back to 1968 and to pleasant times such as this conversation with Margaret Hawkins. The book Lydia's Party is available from Viking Books, with a paperback coming out next year from Viking Penguin. We want to thank Margaret. We want to thank Angela Messina of Viking, Jesse Todd, for helping us arrange this program, recorded back in the spring but broadcast now for the first time. Matt DiStefano put the program together and made it sound great. Our funder, Alphawood Foundation, and other friends of this program, WFMT.com/critical thinking, home of the always free Critical Thinking podcast. Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, if you want to grab me. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.